welcome back to Shattering Myths. Before we turn the page, I want to share a little bit more of this article. The school district advocating political correctness, which is incorrect information, indoctrination. And it's just laid on the line. Political correctness exists to indoctrinate. It is to present that which is untrue, not only as if it were true, but to censure anyone who would criticize their deception, to marginalize them, to punish them. That's the facts here. What the teacher did is factually correct, but it wasn't approved because it wasn't politically correct, because there is no correlation. Politically correct and correct are independent sets. There's no overlap. And so they said, as soon as this issue was brought to our attention, the administration addressed the situation with the teacher, not with Islam, not with their curriculum, but with the teacher. You see, they have to be censured. They have to be punished. Ensuring our students have access to factual information given in the proper context is a priority to our district. No, it isn't. Part of political correctness. It is Machiavellian. The ends justify the means. You can lie. The teacher provided factual information. The district wants unfactual information. The teacher presented the information in the context of terrorism and beheadings. The school district wants it out of context so that they can talk about the five pillars and how lovely it is. Out of the context of pagan Arab practices, out of the context of Sharia law, out of the context of Muhammad, out of the context of the Hadith, out of the context of the Quran. The school district wants to do exactly the opposite of what they said, deprive the children of factual information so that they can indoctrinate them and remove everything from context so that it cannot be understood. Arbitrary curriculum decisions, which are clearly outside of the guidelines, will not be tolerated. What is the mantra of political correctness? We're intolerant of intolerance. And yet look how hypocritical they are. If somebody wants to share something that is inconsistent with their lie, they won't be tolerated. You see, it's just pure hypocrisy. Every aspect of socialist secular humanism is abject hypocrisy. It's just like Christianity, with Paul condemning the very God he says that chose him to speak to Christians. You have to be irrational to be a socialist secular humanist. You've got to park your mind over there in left field. Won't be tolerated. Now, with that, we're going to tolerate our good friend and teacher, artist Kirk, as he has been walking us through. Excuse me, I've got a lot of reasons this morning not to be unhappy, and that's one of them. It's what that does is underscores, their own words underscores exactly what I've been saying, is the single greatest problem in America, the most unresolvable problem, is that Americans generation after generation have been indoctrinated rather than educated, and that they're incapable of distinguishing right from wrong, truth from lies. And that school districts are ensuring that generations of Americans are easy to manipulate and to control, to deprive of their free will by depriving them of the information necessary to make free will useful.
Well, you know, when I was in college in the 70s, Deweyism, or experimentalism that became progressive education, was the method of which they got it into the school systems to begin with, to have political correctness. And everybody balked at it then, but they allowed it as another option. You know, you take a course in that. Mm-hmm. And other courses, and then you take a course in sanity, and then you go back and take that course. So we didn't think that much of it, because no one would stand up and tell you you can't speak the truth, or what you are a specialist in. or something like mm-hmm. that. So in the old days, it was easy to fight it. Although I must tell you that going through college, I challenged professors on everything. Now, I was fortunate. I always made the dean's list. But, boy, I tell you, a couple times I thought I was going to get thrown out of a class because I challenged what they said as myth in those days.
Back in the time that I was a student, I was my methodology as a student was to see how little I could do and get the A. And so I very seldom went to class. I read the textbook and I performed well on tests. So I got essentially all A's all the way through school, but it wasn't because I was challenging. I just learned that this is the answer they wanted, and I had a decent memory, and I gave them the answer they were asking for. It wasn't until I graduated that I developed my disdain for authority and began to challenge everything, you know. So I'm now where you were. It just took me longer to get there.
No, I came to the same conclusion. I kept thinking, and saying, "Oh, now, why are you here? Do you want to get this degree or not?"
Right.
So just give them what they want, and then go paint a picture.
Right. Yeah, I didn't see any part of school as being helpful towards a career.
No.
So I found a few classes helpful in terms of life skills, like logic, rhetoric. I think math is particularly algebra and geometry are thinking skills that are very useful. I thought that learning history had many advantages in terms of providing perspective. But most of what I gained during that period was, you know, I traveled in 150-plus countries. So I saw the world,
right.
And I was a voracious reader of nonfiction materials,
mm-hmm.
and then between sports teams and later in college fraternity, you know, I kind of learned the interactions as how people function together. I mean, the amount of things that I actually learned in the classroom. I don't think there's, for example, anything that I learned in the classroom that was helpful in starting any of the three businesses that I started.
Yeah.
And I just looked at it as these are people who teach because they were not successful doing.
Mm-hmm.
And that they really know very little about the subject that they're teaching. They know facts, but they really don't understand anything. And if I ask them a question that gets to the core of cause and effect, they can't answer me. So I've only found one teacher that I could consistently drill down that seems to have all the right answers, that everything fits, always a cause and effect, always rational, always straightforward, always consistent.
Yeah.
And that's Yahweh in his Torah. That's the only thing that I've ever found that is like that, is always true and has always been true.
Yeah.
But, you know, to do that, though, you really got to drill down. You've got to be willing to invest the time. You've got to let go of a lot of the human deceptions. And you've got to retrain yourself to think. You know, in America, exercising good judgment is a crime. It's a sin. And evidence which is inconsistent with societal mores relative to political correctness mm-hmm. is hateful. And a crime. And so you've really got to work to sweep away what you've been indoctrinated to believe and to respond as, and to, you know, this notion you're entitled to your opinion. Everybody's entitled to their opinion, and that we ought to respect religions and respect our military and respect our political institutions, and that, you know, that's essential for a society to function. You got to sweep that stuff away and then discipline yourself to think logically, rationally, and to invest the time to study the information that's available to us.
So does that mean if I want to become an Aztec tomorrow and cut open your heart and dedicate it to my pagan god, that's okay? Because you got to respect my religion now.
No, it's not okay with me. No,
because
I don't respect your religion. That is correct.
Yeah.
That I don't respect any religion.
Yeah, so that's so stupid to say, you know, for them to say something.
Of course,
like that.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah, get real with these things.
Yeah. And you know, why would I respect an educational institution that is going to prohibit the intolerant of the truth and yet set standards that require indoctrination that is out of context and is dishonest while saying exactly the opposite.
Mm-hmm.
Why would I respect that?
You have to get out of college what you can find there. I found some teachers that actually had been professional artists with great success for years, and I learned from them, but most of the time I spent on the library floor. I mean, that was easy, to me. That was where I could find what I was looking for to get out of it. But I don't know what you do today.
I don't know what you do today. I really don't. I do know that as it relates to the sciences, you know, both of my sons were in the sciences, engineering and organic chemistry. That in the sciences, you can get a really genuine education in the sciences, but you move outside of the sciences. And, the sciences are Yahweh's world. I mean, you were dealing with observation, cause and effect, experimentation, setting up hypotheses, good questions, running probabilities, and seeing if you can, if something is repeatable and observable and quantifiable, and if it is objectively true. And so the sciences and engineering, of course, is so math-based, which is, in math, there's right and wrong.
Yeah.
The bridge is going to perform as designed, or it's not. And so I think that kind of an education is still quite good.
Mm-hmm.
But I think when you move into anything else, you're subjecting yourself to vastly more, not only indoctrination, propaganda, religious material under the guise of socialist secular humanism, but you're actually receiving a preponderance of inaccurate information, and you're being deprived of context and being deprived of exercising good judgment. So I think most of it's actually counterproductive.
Yeah. Well, I'm not sure I would send a kid to college. I like the old days when you went to some type of technical school, about the high school or something like that. You could go to business college or art school or something like that.
Even in business, I have a son that's a scientist, but he's taking, in his evenings, he's taking business classes. Because what I told him, since he wants to work in business with his science degree, that he needs to be able to speak the language of business. And so you take business classes to speak the language of business, but boy, you even got to be a little careful there. Welcome back to Shattering the Story. Kirk, you had gone through, I believe, 3, perhaps 4 words that were corrupted to pray. And thus far, you didn't have any that even remotely
resembled,
conveyed the concept of pray.
Exactly.
You know, the last one I think you were working with was...
We had 6, and one was a root or an ana, but so it's 5 to 6, depending on how you want to count.
Okay. Ana was one of them, which is the Hebrew word for please. It says that rather than issuing a command or a demand, you're asking somebody to do something in a polite, familial way.
Mm-hmm.
That's not prayer.
No.
That's an attitude. It's an attitude you can apply to prayer if you wish to.
Mm-hmm.
But it's an attitude that you would apply, and mostly would apply, in a family setting with between husbands and wives, between parents and their children and their parents, between siblings. You know, could you please help me out with this?
Sure.
So that's not prayer.
No.
And then you had one that I think was conveyed the idea of sweeping stuff away.
Mm-hmm.
That was convoluted to prayer, and all that does when Yahweh was using that is if you don't sweep away the indoctrination of man, the culture of man, if you're not willing to walk away from patriotism and politics and religion and all of the gunk, that all of the lies of mankind, if you're not willing to start to sweep that away, then Yahweh doesn't want anything to do with you, because he realizes you're just not in a position where you could even process the truth, much less accept it.
Mm-hmm.
And so that has nothing to do with prayer.
No.
So I think you had a few more that were...
I do. We had 10 altogether.
Okay.
And And this was, you know, dedicated to all the people who think that King Iams was in God and country and all that sort of good stuff and the inerrant word of God and the King
James. Yeah, it's not even a remotely accurate translation.
Not on the most common things that they say every day, the prayer, the praise, to the worship service
and
stuff.
Oh, yeah, and it's filled with things that are just outright deceptions.
Well, it's some pretty good examples, and we're just barely scraping the surface on
it. Oh, but it was authorized. It was authorized.
Well, of course it was.
You know, all the rest of you have to worry about what's the authorized world. We've got the authorized, by the way. You know, the King Iams never authorized it.
No.
No, he never did authorize it.
he
wanted it done, but he never issued a decree. And Sir Francis Bacon provided it for him, who was a Rosicrucian, which means he was an occultist, for political reasons, because the Bishop Bible and the Geneva Bible, particularly the Geneva, becoming incredibly, which was an English translation, was becoming incredibly popular because this English translation pointed out that there was no divine authority for kings, and that the kings claim that their authority was God-given was false.
Yeah.
The only place, by the way, you can find submit to the authorities because they've been put in place by God is guess who?
Paul,
13th chapter of Romans.
Hello.
Yeah, Paul is telling us that the Roman Empire, that he specifically called the most vicious, duplicitous, and destructive beast in all of human history, that he put in place for good, and you should submit to the very thing that Yahweh said you should walk away from. But, you know, good luck with you Christians that think that Paul wrote Scripture.
Word number 7.
Okay.
In the middle of our prayer meeting here.
Word
number 7. We have a word, Palal. It's a pay and a couple of lambs and lambed L.
Variations of Palal aren't variations of Palal the single most common Hebrew word for prayer?
Yes. It's 84 times, I believe, or more.
Yeah, and that's just in the Palal form, but it has variations of that. Mm-hmm. And what's interesting is that Palal, which is the primary Hebrew word or root for prayer, it's only found 6 times in the Torah. And never once does Yahweh say we should do it. Never once does he tie it to our participation in the covenant. Never once does he associate with our relationship with him. Never once does he associate it with salvation or say it's part of salvation. Mm-hmm. Never once does he encourage us to do it. Never once does he say, boy, that person is doing that, and that really pleases me. Never once.
Well, here's why. It's the root word would mean plead, like plead to an authority,
mm-hmm.
and also the secondary meaning is judgment. Now, when you think mm-hmm. of judgment in prayer together, then you're on the wrong side of this meeting.
You. Yeah, well, please, pleading, judge me. No, I don't think so. Or just say, please, let me judge. I'm pleading that I can judge you. No, I don't think so. It is true, Kirk, that the primary lexicon meaning for Palal, which is the primary Hebrew word rendered prayer, is to plead. And the secondary meaning is judgment.
Mm-hmm.
So are you pleading for judgment?
Well,
are you wanting to judge? I mean, there's, you know, plead is there's something that you want. So do you want to judge? Do you want to be judged? Are you pleading for judgment? I mean, when the audience is God, I wouldn't equate that to prayer.
No. And, you know, if you're in the middle of a judgment and you're being judged by Yah, you're doomed already, so don't compound it by saying, Lord, Lord.
Now I would go with this, and this is something that struck me when I studied the word.
Uh-huh.
That to want, to plead is to want. That's to desire. And it's to request because you want. It's an expression of free will and of desire in a respectful way. Okay, so I'm okay with Palal starting with that. And then the Hebrew concept of judgment is very seldom the pronouncement of judgment, of somebody saying, I judge that you be condemned to death. No. It's executing good judgment.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you were to render the word with its primary, you want something, you desire something, you're requesting something in a polite way,
right,
which is the primary meaning. With the secondary meaning, associated with judgment, what's wrong with wanting to exercise good judgment?
Nothing, but you know, you could also say that you're wanting to be led, or you're asking to be led.
Oh, well, that's looking at the letters.
We'll get to that in a moment.
So if you wanted to exercise good judgment relative to God, what would you do? What is the primary prerequisite on being able to exercise good judgment relative to anyone, in particular God?
Well, you have to think, and you have to observe and study and know.
First thing you have to do is you have to observe so that you come to know.
Sure.
How do you execute judgment, good judgment, if you haven't any information to be discerning regarding?
You can't make a rule on a case, for instance, if you don't have the information.
Right. So it's like, you know, exercising good judgment as a juror until you're presented information. All you're doing is you've got your opinions. I don't like the way they look. I don't like people with mustaches. I don't like people with tattoos. And so all you're doing is, I don't like people whose skin color is like American Indians. Yeah, they're like savages. So until you have information, you cannot exercise good judgment.
Mm-hmm.
That's what political correctness does. Like school districts were trying to preclude their students from having good information, because even if they tried to be judgmental, once they received information, without information, it's useless. All you have is opinions. Now, so we're dealing with a word that would, by its definition, would say that you want to exercise good judgment. The prerequisite for that is observing so that you know the facts about the subject you're going to exercise good judgment about. This is particularly being directed at God, so you would have to read his teaching, his guidance, his Torah.
Mm-hmm.
You'd have to know what he said. And then before you could exercise good judgment, you'd have to make connections and think about it, come to understand it, right?
Absolutely. No, knowledge and understanding.
Is that like prayer in the sense of, you know, prayer in Christianity is you're talking to God. Now, the inverse of that would be you'd be listening to God.
Mm-hmm.
So wouldn't the inverse, the religious concept, be the result of observing what Yahweh had to say and then thinking about it and coming to understand it? So you're listening to him?
That would be a better prayer.
Yeah, but the antithesis really of talking to God is listening to God.
Yeah.
Now, how many times does Yahweh in his Torah tell us to talk to him?
The door is open, but he wants you to listen.
Yes. Hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of times he tells you to observe what he said and to listen to what he said. Hundreds and hundreds of times. He never once tells you to talk to him. You know why?
Because
until you listen to what he has to say, what do you have to say to him?
Yeah, you don't know what to even ask.
You wouldn't even know that you don't need to ask.
Yeah, that's true.
That's what Yahushua was saying. He said, you don't need to ask. You know, if you're part of Yahweh's family, you don't need to ask. If you know what Yahweh wants, what he desires, and what he's offering, you don't need to ask. God's not putting us in a position where we need to ask.
You know, and he starts off on the mountain, and he didn't say, y'all all tell me what your grievances are.
No.
Let me tell you, let's sit down, let's talk, and I'm going to do the talking, y'all do the listening.
You do the listening. He is in a different position than we are in. Once we've done some listening, and we've come to benefit from his teaching, his guidance, his direction, and we have been adopted into his family, been perfected and enriched by him, then it is an open dialogue. We're talking to him, he's talking to us, but And at that point, we know who he is. We benefit from what he has to offer. We're about exploring everything together for all time. Then it's a dialogue. But that just is a natural part of having listened to what he has to say first. But if you don't begin with listening, you'll never get anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
He'll never listen to you. He'll never hear you until you listen to him first. And so the Christian concept of prayer and praying for one's salvation, you know, the Billy Graham crusade thing, it's the antithesis of what we should do. Rather than get down on our knees before we go to bed, rather than praying over a meal, rather than asking God for this, that, and the other thing, rather than some public nonsense of prayer, it's the opposite of what we should do. It's not only the wrong thing to do, it's the opposite of what we should do.
Hmm.
Listen to what he has to say.
You know, the unfortunate side in my life was that was the kind of church I went to. It was a lecture thing by a so-alleged scholar. I mean, he was a scholar, but he and right. We didn't pray in church. There was never prayer done. We'd say, "Go pray in your closet."
Yeah.
And he would lecture, and then you get out of it what you got out of it. But unfortunately, he was a Paulinist and couldn't get overcome that, and therefore everything was tainted.
You can't listen. To God if you're listening to Paul.
No, that's exactly.
You're not listening to God. You're listening to the antithesis of God when you're listening to Paul.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay. So let's. So that's the meaning of the word.
Right.
Let's now go into the letters that comprise the word. It's philal is the three letters, right?
Yeah. It's a P and two lamb.
Yeah.
Two L. So it's a P-L-L. And, of course, one is the mouth, and we think of nourishment, words, and so forth. But you could also, when we speak, we use our mouth. So you could ask for, if you wish, you could ask for guidance.
What are the two repeated letters in Paul?
The two L's, the lamb,
staff. What is the, so it's a separate staff, right? And isn't L the letter that distinguishes Almighty God's title?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it is. So he's telling us he's the shepherd. And you have two of them, don't you?
Yes. So
who do you think we ought to be listening to? Do you think that that mouth that's there is indicated that we should be yabbering to the shepherd? Or do you think that mouth is there because we ought to be listening
to
the shepherd?
Mm-hmm.
And we ought to be listening to the shepherd. Because if we listen to the shepherd, the lamed in Hebrew is the is in the top two or three prepositions. Prepositions denote direction. And it means toward, to approach.
Mm-hmm.
If you want to approach the shepherd, who is God, who is providing guidance and leadership and protection and nourishment and taking care of his flock, leading his flock, if you want to approach him, La, from Lamed, you ought to listen to him.
Mm-hmm.
And how today would you go about listening to God? Would you go out and sit in the middle of a beach and turn your palms of your hands up and start humming?
Mm-hmm. No.
Would you be yabbering to him in prayer if you wanted to listen to him?
That's pretty hard to do.
Would you read the testimony of someone who contradicted everything he said?
No, absolutely not.
Would you turn to human indoctrination if you wanted to listen to God?
I don't think you find him there.
No. So if you wanted to listen to God, where would you go?
You go to the Torah.
Recite it, right?
The only rational place.
Yeah. So this is mouth, which is spoken word. Shepherd. And the shepherd is not only the sign of leadership and guidance and nourishing and protecting, but the lamed that makes up this word as a preposition, which is how it's most commonly used, means to approach. You want to approach the shepherd? Listen to what he has to say. Mouth his words, recite his testimony.
But King James says that's prayer.
And they would assume incorrectly that prayer is us talking to God.
Yes.
Even though the person that they don't even know their name, that claims that they claim to have named their religion after, said, "You don't need to tell God what you want. He already knows what you need.
Yeah.
And he says, don't do this. So, okay, so palal, which is the primary meaning for, word for prayer, means to approach the shepherd by listening to his words.
Mm-hmm. Okay. You know, it just makes me feel really stupid when I was. I'm so stupid. Anyway, next word is I'm going to pronounce it tisla, or it's a T-S-L sound, a T-S.
Okay.
And that one, surprisingly, the first meaning is shadow, like in the shade, and then a place of shadows. And I was trying to think, well, gosh, how do they get around? What does that really mean? And you keep studying a little bit. Now, there's an Aramaic word where they add an aleph at the end of it, and it means there is a to be resting and waiting.
Mm-hmm.
And on obviously an authority, so
and
you're going
Aramaic
to stay
Hebrew,
your rest, and you have a resting man, so it's
Tisbe is a resting individual, right? Individual laying down.
Yes, absolutely.
Okay, and then the other letter is the lament.
Lament again.
And we're gonna, since it's gonna take some time, we'll develop that later. But the concept of shadow in Hebrew is a dimensional concept.
Mm-hmm.
It indicates our relative dimensions compared to Yahweh. We are less dimension. Our shadow is a two-dimensional representation of our three-dimensional being. Welcome back to Shattering Mystery. Continuing to have a discussion with Kirk over these the words that are rendered religiously in the King James Bible. We began with the yesterday with the concept of prayer. We several days prior, we covered the concept of praise, and we found there is no correlation of any kind between the words that Yahweh used and praise as it is exhibited in a religious setting. And we're going over the word for prayer, and we're finding that there's no justification for yabbering at God. None. So let's look at the most recent word that you have. It also has a lament. Boy, there is a
lot of laments.
Boy, as it relates to this behavior, there's a lot of lament. So there's a lot of shepherding here, isn't there?
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you want to be shepherded, you're a sheep, and you want to be shepherded, do you have to pay attention to the shepherd?
Still,
you know, occasionally, ought you, you know, look in the shepherd's direction?
You should, yes.
If you want to be rescued by the shepherd, do you think you need to get the shepherd's attention?
I think your eyes should be totally focused.
Yeah, if the shepherd says, you know, here, he's kind of got some guidelines. He says, okay, we're going to operate as a flock here. I'm going to do everything I can to nourish you, protect you, make sure you have plenty to drink, plenty to eat, that you're kept safe, and that we really have a good time together. I'm going to take you to all sorts of beautiful places. Do you have to kind of come to know what the shepherd's all about?
I think anybody that has a dog, you know, the dog will watch your every move, so they'll pay.
Right. Yeah, what if you were a sheep and you said, you know, I want to be a black sheep. I think that shepherd is mean. I think that shepherd is vengeful. I want to create a mythical shepherd, and I want to convince the rest of the sheep to ignore the real shepherd. And to follow me as we follow after a mythical concept of a shepherd.
Shepherd. Mm-hmm.
Are you going to benefit from the shepherd? The actual shepherd?
That's sudden death.
Yeah. And by the way, are you going to benefit from the imaginary shepherd?
You have no benefit from the imaginary.
No. Lose game. What we just introduced, by the way, is religion. The black sheep creating religion. Okay, so what you have is in the concept of this word whose meaning is shadow. The primary concept of shadow in Hebrew is you're dealing with a three-dimensional construct, people, for example, or a tree or a mountain, three-dimensional construct, rendered in two dimensions. When Yahweh uses the concept that he created us in his image, the word that he used conveys shadow.
Mm-hmm.
It conveys the concept of rendering something in fewer dimensions. I have plans for the home that I'm living in. My home is three-dimensional. The plans are two dimensions.
All right.
Okay. So Yahweh was telling us that he made himself and made us in his image, but in lesser dimensions.
Right.
So that's what the shadow concept means. So when we have the perspective of the shadow, what we're recognizing is that in our current state, as we're relating to Yahweh and coming to know him, he's greater dimensions. The one that designed us is greater dimensions. This falls into Roy's idea that the creator of this universe has to be outside of this universe in a dimension beyond what we ourselves can function in.
Sure.
And understand. Otherwise, they would not be infinite. Otherwise, they could not do what they're doing. That's what. So this just tells us that God is in a dimension that is beyond ours.
Mm-hmm.
That's pretty clue, right? That's good stuff.
Good stuff.
Okay, and then you've got two letters. You got a person resting.
Yes.
And you have a shepherd's staff. Boy, that one's really hard. Boy, how in the world are we going to define that concept?
Well, you could rest in Yah.
Yeah. Let Yah do the work. Let the shepherd do the work of protecting, of nurturing, of leading, of exploring, of doing all the things that shepherds do for the flock. And we are just going to rest and relax in his company. That means that we don't need to be responsible for our own protection, doesn't it?
No.
That means we don't need to be responsible for our own nourishment, does it?
No, sir.
Doesn't all it means that we need to be in sync with the guidance of the shepherd, and the shepherd's going to take care of everything. That's what that means,
right.
Doesn't it?
Absolutely.
Okay, well, that works pretty well for me. I don't know how you get prayer out of that.
I don't either. Well, some of these, they just don't found me.
How often is that one used, by the way, or rendered?
Unless you're, they're trying to say you're prostrate before God or something, and then that's, God, that's a stretch.
How often is that one, the TSL, rendered prayer?
Not a lot. 2-3-4 times.
Okay.
I guess. At least two times that I'm aware of, and a couple of times in Aramaic somewhere.
Okay. Well, we'll continue this because I think you have 10 all total.
I have two more, and then we got a few words for worship.